Film Spotting is presented by Spout.com, a gathering place for people who love movies. Sign up for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And from Milwaukee, I'm Sam Van Halgren. On this week's show, Adam and I play pretend and cast the five actors we want in our movie.
Plus, listener feedback, massacre theater, music from The Winter Sounds, and the fourth film in our film noir marathon, Gun Crazy.
But we begin with a film best served with warm brie and a baguette.
Well, he'll be in tomorrow. How about yours?
Oh, yours can take care of both of us, I'm sure. I don't think you're trying to hide your assets from me.
So you still like it here, huh?
I love it.
And that book guy, you still in your life?
No, he's long gone.
Or somebody else?
Mm-hmm.
Another author?
No. This one doesn't work. Well, he works, but it seems, you know, more of a hobby.
That's Ben Gazzara and Jenna Rowlands as sparring ex-lovers in a scene from the multi-director movie Valentine to the capital of France, Paris, Je T'aime. I don't know about you, but my favorite kind of food is a buffet. If I don't like one thing, I'm sure to like another. For some reason, however, this hasn't held true for movie buffets. Think New York Stories, Four Rooms, the recent Eros. Not that there are many movie buffets like Paris Je T'aime, which features 18 writer-directors using 18 of the City of Lights' arrondissement as a backdrop for 18 love stories, but vignette-style films have in general left me feeling full but never satisfied, not unlike a lot of people feel about the Chinese buffets I'm always picking for lunch. As directors used to bigger palettes contemplate a small canvas, there seem to be alternate temptations to overstuff and to underplay. One tries to squeeze in too much meaning or cleverness or plot out of a five-minute scene. The other decides better to do nothing at all. The other challenge is in assembling all the pieces, which in the case of Paris Je T'aime falls to producer Emmanuel Benbihi and a couple of collaborators, and is the equivalent of building a perfect mix CD out of five or so minute vignettes, which run the emotional gamut between comedy, tragedy, relevance, absurdity, sincerity, cruelty, never mind the appearance of vampires, mimes, cowboys, and Nick Nolte. Adam, a movie like this begs two questions. How does the movie work as a whole? Are there more hits than misses? And is it worth spending 2 hours of your life with? And second, who wins? Which art house heavyweight takes home the prize? Gus Van Sant, Alexander Payne, Alfonso Cuarón, Tom Tykwer, the Coen brothers? Or were you, like me, taken by surprise and sent to IMDb scrambling for information about a new favorite director?
Well, to start with, I can't wait to hear which director you have in mind there, because unlike you, it seems, actually, for me, my favorite films in the bunch were, with one exception, by directors I was familiar with before. So we'll see. Maybe the one exception to that rule maybe is the same one that you had. So we'll see in a minute. I can give you a quick preview of who didn't win here, and it's two of the names that you mentioned. For me, it's not the Coen brothers or Alfonso Cuarón, disappointingly, two directors that we both really like. But yeah, to get back to your first question, is it worth your time? Are there more hits than misses? Well, with a film like this, it's great. It's really convenient. We can actually have a little bit of a scorecard, can't we? We can put the 18 films down and kind of rank them. And I didn't rank them, but I did put them into groups of 1 to 4 stars in terms of the movies I really liked, movies I liked, movies I thought didn't work all that well, but maybe were okay, and then the ones that I did dislike. And the way it came out for me is there were 4 that I really liked, there were 4 that I liked, there were 6 that were in that 2-star group of movies that didn't quite work, and then there were 4 finally that I didn't like much at all. So if you add that up, I guess it's 10-8 in terms of the
oh,
movies
it's close.
I didn't like, 10-8 misses, but some of those that were in that 6 camp, in that 2-star camp, I can say are just on the verge. So for me, if I really was going to balance it out, it would come out pretty much half and half. There were about 9 hits here, about 9 misses, and I would say that the 9 hits make it worth your while. For me, it was still an enjoyable experience because of those 9 films. But one thing I realized watching it, and now we get into the Coen brothers and some of the films that I think don't work, is watching this movie and watching these films that are only 5 to 6 minutes long, I realized how hard comedy is to pull off in that brief a span of time, because it's difficult to come up with a scenario that really works and gives you something more than just a gimmick, because none of the funny ones in this film really did anything for me. Most notably, the Coen brothers film with Steve Buscemi, which I just didn't find particularly funny or clever in the slightest. It's basically Buscemi playing an American tourist. It's almost all unspoken, being accosted by two lovers in the metro station as he's waiting for a train because he unfortunately makes eye contact with them. And it just really, for me, didn't work. That was one of the big disappointments. And the other big disappointment was Alfonso Cuarón's film with Nick Nolte because, A, I have no idea what Nick Nolte is doing the entire 5 minutes.
Until the very end. It is more or less a punchline.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is a punchline. You get back to that gimmick idea I mentioned. That really is kind of, there's a little twist there. But I don't know that it makes everything we've seen worth it. And the other big problem is that, unlike what he did with Children of Men, he actually let the filmmaking become a distraction. He let the technical side of it obscure the characters and the scenario because I was so busy watching this long tracking shot, this unbroken five-minute take, glide through the Paris street, I didn't have any care at all about what Nick Nolte was saying at all to this much younger woman as she discussed what seems to be on the surface to be a story about her boyfriend or guy issue. So Cuarón, I don't think, was going for humor as much, but by the end, as you said, it's kind of a one-note joke, and that little twist didn't quite come together for me. So for me, by the end of it, it really was the serious films that were actually able to take a very small but heavy or sometimes painful dramatic moment and expand it into 5 minutes in a really interesting way, in a way that made me actually want to see an entire film with these characters. And that's, for me, I guess, how I came out deciding which ones were the most effective films. They're the ones that, when they got over, they had a life beyond that 5 minutes on screen that I was still thinking about or thought I would enjoy an entire feature. And so I will just quickly mention the four that worked for me and then toss it to you because I can't wait to hear which ones you really liked. But the ones that did work for me really well were actually Walter Salles' film, starring Catalina Sandino Moreno, Bastille, written and directed by Isabel Coixet. I hope I'm saying her name right, or Coixet. And Tom Tickford's film did impress me a lot, actually, and also the one that we played a clip from, Jenna Rollins and Ben Gazzara, directed by Gerard Depardieu and also Frederick Aubertin. That film isn't serious or painful or dramatic, but those actors are so amazing in the scene.
Yeah.
And they have such a natural life and rhythm together that I just enjoyed watching them on screen. So those were the big four for me that really worked. What about you?
No, it sounds like we liked the same, and it's interesting. Overall, I'd say that I was more forgiving of the pieces themselves, but maybe less forgiving as a whole. I think it's worth seeing because I think there are far more, in my case, that work than don't work. But there still is a problem with these kind of films in that the ones that don't work so throw off the momentum of the whole movie that If a film or a short film or a vignette, in this case, is 5 or so minutes long, or certainly not longer than 5 minutes long, and you can't wait for it to be over, that's a problem, and it does throw off everything. And I think instead of 18, I would have slimmed this down to about 12. Yeah. I think there were about 12 that I did like to some degree. I think I actually loved, I'll say I loved one, and it's funny you didn't mention it at all. Seven I liked quite a bit, actually. Five I liked, and five I really didn't like at all. And I would say, with those that I didn't like, as we mentioned, they sort of more or less turn into punchlines or become preachy. I think of this second piece particularly. There's only one that was really, really kind of brutal, where we have this young French boy meeting this young Arab girl. In terms of its cringeworthy preachiness.
Gurinder Chadha.
Yeah. Even that had sort of moments for me, which sort of redeemed it.
I liked it more than you.
Yeah, well, I didn't care for it at all. That was probably my least favorite just because of its preachiness. But as far as what I liked the best, the one I actually loved and it didn't, again, had me going to IMDb immediately and finding out who Oliver Schmitz is, who directed a piece called Place de Fête, which is this really just wonderful, I consider it like a perfect piece of cinema, actually. It's humane, suspenseful, funny, heartbreaking. You have this African immigrant to Paris. Really, we see him experiencing his last few moments on Earth and his interaction with this EMT. And just the way the story is told really, really creatively, and in 5 minutes, get a sense of who this person is, who two people are, really, and how their lives intersect. Really, really deeply moving and everything. If every single one of these, if every one of the films in Paris Your Thème was anything like what Oliver Schmitz's Place de Fête attempted to do or his ambition was, this would have been a completely different experience. But I really did love that. other ones you mentioned that I liked a lot, Tickverse, I was really impressed. And again, the story, like the vignette with Jenna Rollins and Ben Gazzara, Tickverse isn't really original in its theme. It really is just about a relationship, a certain moment in a relationship. This young couple played by Natalie Portman and Melchior Belson is blind. And it really, Tickver just is a technical wizard. Mm-hmm. Really, he really encapsulates the entire experience of this relationship in 5 minutes. It really is a wonder to behold.
I hear you. Who is Bruno?
I'm rehearsing, can't you see?
No. Sorry.
No, I'm sorry.
You're an actress?
Trying to be. I have an audition today.
At the conservatoire?
Yeah.
You mentioned not being impressed by any of the comedy. Obviously, you weren't as impressed as I was by Sylvain Chomet's his mime, absurdist right. mime rant. And I think part of it was that it was just somebody was sort of throwing out the rules and having fun. Mm-hmm. So many of these other directors, I think, took the theme of love so seriously that I was really happy to see somebody break the mold. And it was genuinely funny. It was the only time I actually laughed out loud. And Sylvain Chomet, if you're not familiar with the name, directed The Triplets of Belleville, one of my favorite animated films. Mm-hmm. But I think it's genuinely inspired and funny. I also really liked, you mentioned Isabelle Coixet's Bastille, which is the one that really surprised me, I think. Mm-hmm. Miranda Richardson is this woman who tells her husband is about to end the relationship and leave with his mistress, but she tells him that that she's suffering from a fatal case of leukemia. And I expected it to go in one direction. I expected it to be kind of cruel and funny to watch this painful experience, mm-hmm. and really it becomes quite moving. And so that really surprised me. And I think there was really only one, and you didn't mention it, and I'm surprised because you love Maggie Gyllenhaal, but the scene directed by Oliver Assayas with Maggie Gyllenhaal playing this Hollywood actress scoring some dope. Again, not a particularly innovative scene, mm-hmm. but it's maybe the one vignette that seemed to be a scene from a potentially interesting full film.
Maybe.
All of them were either successful within the format they've given themselves or failed within the format, I thought.
Yeah, I don't know. That scene, despite my love for Maggie Gyllenhaal, actually that portion of the film really didn't do anything for me. I thought that was one that didn't really have a cohesive structure in a way that made it by the end of it feel like the other ones that really work in this film, like a parable. I think the ones that really work are really effective parables. They have a lesson to them on some level. Maybe the ones that get too preachy, like Gurinder Chadha's, even though mm-hmm. I liked it more than you, those don't really work as much. And actually, I feel like that one is maybe the only reason why the one you like so much, Oliver Schmitz's film, for me, I think maybe it was just almost too heavy. It took me out of the context of the film, but I didn't really have a problem with it. That actually, for me, is definitely one that's in the camp of the three stars I liked, and I might even be willing to bump it up to that higher category. For me, that was one that really worked, but you're absolutely right about Tickver's film, and even though I like him and we've had him on the show, I was totally prepared for some reason to not like his film. I was prepared to think that, okay, here's where Tickver is going to get really flashy and really stylized, and he does. There's a lot of camera and editing tricks like you'd expect, but he really does, as you said, he captures this beginning, end, and then a new beginning of a relationship in a really interesting way, and captures the monotony of that whole structure to a relationship, the habits, the patterns. And of course, like with Tickver, it's all about the senses. We have a character who's blind. He can't see, but to hear and touch and feel and to just use your mind, use your imagination. I thought that was really fascinating. His was definitely one that stuck out for me.
Yeah, I just think there was so much care in that. I think there are certain films like Tickver's, and I think Oliver Schmitz, who's a South African director, there's a degree of care with which they made the film, really thought it out, and used the sort of art of cinema to tell their story, in a, you know, which needed to be told really quickly. I feel like some just sort of more or less went on a lark.
Yeah.
I mean, they sort of were like, oh, 5 minutes, love in Paris, that's fine. And I feel like there is a kind of imbalance there. And sometimes that could work, I think, if some had a more improvisational feel. But I think, like you said, they all were, to more or less successful degrees, attempting at this parable. And I totally agree. I mean, the one I thought of specifically was the one we've already talked about, this Bastille with Miranda Richardson, this this man who learns how to fall back in love with his wife who's dying of cancer. And I think that's a perfect parable, absolutely. And I think you're right, a lot of the rest of them do. There's another great one with Juliette Binoche as a mother grieving for the loss of her dead son. Again, you're right, works perfectly as this kind of parable of overcoming grief and really does it well and uses this really fanciful notion. I mean, or this fanciful device of Willem Dafoe showing up on a horse as a cowboy. And it's just like it really took some chances within a small time frame. And I think you mentioned Walter Salles's, which I really liked a lot as well. But I almost feel like it was so simple and almost I really liked the way it was filmed. I loved the actress in the film. But it still was trying to be it almost was too tidy in some way. And I think some of them were too tidy and didn't take enough chances. But again, Salles was one I liked a lot, too.
Yeah, I think. For me, though, because it's so tidy is what I liked about it so much. It's so simple. And this is a film, because people out there who haven't seen this movie may not have any idea what we're talking about, but Catalina Sandina Moreno plays this woman who basically the story is her getting up and leaving her baby to travel way across Paris on the metro to get to a house where she's taking care of some rich white woman's baby. And it's very simple, but I really think that it's so subtle, and he does it in a really non-heavy-handed way and gives us these great lessons, I think, about how we can take her struggle for granted, how she's taken for granted, and yet how there are certain things that are universal no matter how big the gap is between the character we see and the woman that she's going to care for her child. So for me, Walter Salles' film was one that, despite its simplicity, really did work for me. I think I want to close, Sam, and unfortunately I don't think we're going to have time to really get into it, but we have to mention Alexander Payne's film, because I've actually seen a couple of cases where some critics have said that this is the part of the film, this is the one chapter in the film that stood out the most, and I know that you're typically an Alexander Payne detractor. Real quick, how did he do in this film for you?
Well, great writer, but like so many of his other films, I felt like he really does take pleasure out of people's pain and misery, and I feel like ultimately he's making fun of his central character, which I think is typical of Alexander Payne.
See, I actually think that it says something more about the people watching the film who think that than Alexander Payne. I think that's especially true in this film. I actually didn't like his film, mainly because I don't think the epiphany at the end adds up to anything at all, which is the whole film is building up to that. But in terms of how we view that character, I don't think you can view her with contempt at all unless you're someone who views her with contempt. I don't think Alexander Payne does, but that's my take, and we could spend an entire show on that one segment probably.
Could. But there obviously is, I think, a lot to like here. I think it's absolutely worth tracking down on DVD. I'm not sure it's necessary. Well, I think it's worth seeing if you want to, but I definitely think it's worth renting where you can skip through some of the parts that are less effective. Paris Chatham is currently in limited release. If you've seen it and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voicemail.
Time for a quick break. When we come back, what I wasn't ready for, unfortunately, was the omission of my number one movie about journalism, Good Night and Good Luck. It was only afterward that I remembered you were both apparently high when you saw that movie. Sam and I put down the bong next in listener feedback. Stay with us.
A windy city night when I remembered you and I. You brought me life and like the others before you. When we stood on top of the project, we stood in two far fears of the yonder. Will you still remember me like I am here before you now? And I feel the same love. Will you always think of me like I am 6 feet underground? And our world is gone,
We have told the Air Force that we will provide facilities for any comment, criticism, or corrections it may wish to make in regard to the case of Milo Radulovich. We are unable to judge the charges against the lieutenant's father or sister because neither we, nor you, nor they, nor the lawyers, nor the lieutenant know precisely what was contained in that manila envelope.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam, and that was a clip from Good Night and Good Luck, the George Clooney-directed film, one that definitely came up a lot in listener emails. We'll get into some of that feedback here in a moment in response to our top five movies about journalism from last week, but we wanted to start with our poll question, starting with the one from last week. We asked about the movie Sicko, and if you heard last week's show, we of course mentioned that Sicko was what we were hoping to review on this week's show.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, Sam, we both had a week where we were out of town for most of the week, both of us. And so we weren't able to get to an advanced screening of Sicko, which opens here this weekend. We also weren't able to get to an advanced screening of Ratatouille. And basically, I convinced you that I thought it was more important to talk about Parashutam than Die Hard. We'll see whether or not I rue.
Your pretentiousness
that
really
persuasion.
Kicked into high gear. You were bullied by our message boards.
That's true. Bullied by our message boards, but I really thought that we owed it to our listeners to talk about something a little more serious than maybe Die Hard, though I am, like you, curious to see Die Hard. So at some point, I'm sure we'll share some thoughts on the latest John McClane entry, but we are going to get to Sicko actually on next week's show. Sam, you are moving this month. You are moving into your new home. You have a busy month. We're going to have a couple of guest hosts, Scott Smith, the web editor from Time Out Chicago, who has filled in for you before very capably.
Absolutely.
He's going to come in and sit in next week, and we're going to talk about Sicko. And we asked you last week on filmspotting.net, Sicko opens June 29th. To date, Michael Moore's best work is Bowling for Columbine, The Big One, Roger and Me, Fahrenheit 9/11, or if it's Moore, it's bad. Sam, how did it come out?
Well, 42% sided with me and said Bowling for Columbine is Michael Moore's best. 29% said Roger and Me, which is what you said, Adam.
Mm-hmm.
16%, a healthy margin, I think, say if it's Moore, it's bad. 12% Fahrenheit 9/11, and only 1% The Big One.
Well, we did have one listener write in and say, how dare we leave off Canadian bacon?
I know, I saw that.
So I guess we did
yet
put together
by me, I'm sad to say.
A faulty poll question there, Sam, I guess. So I'm a little surprised, 42% Bowling for Columbine. Maybe I shouldn't be. I know it was a very big film for him, but as we've talked about before, a movie for me, I know it was your choice, but for me, by the end, I felt like Moore just basically threw out a lot of great ideas and then blamed it all on the media. So for me, that film didn't work as effectively as some of his others, but Sicko, definitely one we're curious to check out, and again, we'll talk about it on next week's show. Turning to this week's poll question, Transformers, which Scott Smith and I will also spend a few minutes on next week's show. The Michael Bay film is coming out over the July 4th weekend.
I mean, let's admit it, I just didn't want to embarrass myself.
That's right. With Michael Bay trying to cash in on your childhood with Transformers, do you fancy yourself?
Do you fancy yourself in Autobot, Optimus Prime Rules, a Decepticon? I even knew how to pronounce Decepticon.
Good job.
All Hail Megatron, a GoBot, Transformers Suck, I Have No Idea What You're Talking About, or I Know What You're Talking About, But I Was Into My Little Pony.
Mm-hmm.
Nice, good choice. Of course, regular listeners of this show will know I have no idea what you're talking about.
I'm surprised you even got out the words Autobot and Optimus
in
Prime.
In one take, no less.
Really, you did a fantastic job there, but that is where you're going. I have no idea. I'm going with, unfortunately, I'm an Autobot, I guess.
Wow.
Optimus Prime Rules. I mean, I was like any dorky kid, for the most part, who was really into Transformers, and unfortunately, I guess I didn't have a dark side to me. I thought the Autobots were the heroic ones, and so I rooted for them against the evil Decepticons. So I guess that's just me. I'm boring. Maybe with the new film, maybe I'll find the bad guys a little more appealing, Sam.
Yeah, I guess so.
We'll see.
I have nothing to add to this conversation, as you know.
I know you don't. We're really curious. And that poll question, courtesy of our fine message board moderator, Alex Nesnick, who I think is going with the My Little Pony option.
I was wondering who suggested that. That didn't sound like you.
No, it didn't. That was Alex. So a great question there.
I was a He-Man guy.
You were,
I guess I've had my day in the sun.
Yeah, I was into He-Man as well. All right, well, make your voice heard. Go to filmspotting.net and vote in the Transformers poll. Well, let's move on then, Sam, to the feedback to our top five journalism movies. It was a tie-in with our review last week of A Mighty Heart and my discussion with Michael Winterbottom. And we start here with this one from Matt, who says, Adam and Sam, as you started your top five journalism lists, I readied myself for the disappointment of not hearing my number two film, His Girl Friday, on either of your lists. I was pleasantly surprised when it showed up on both. What I wasn't ready for, unfortunately, was the omission of my number one, Good Night and Good Luck. It was only afterward that I remembered you were both apparently high when you saw that movie, because you both failed to realize how great it was. 3 stars? Sorry, guys, but you really missed the boat on that one. better luck next time. And again, as I mentioned coming into this segment, Sam, he certainly wasn't alone.
No.
Also, Sean Lane here chimed in with good night and good luck and many others.
Yeah, Sean writes, I liked both of your top five lists. I can't argue with any of the picks. That said, I'm arguing with the picks. Two films that came to mind that would have made my top five are Good Night and Good Luck and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Good Night and Good Luck was a great example of how courage is sometimes necessary for journalists to really do their jobs in an era when the administration and its lackeys condemn all criticism as akin to aiding and abetting terrorism. We need this film more than ever, which is why I think a lot of people like this film, because it was saying something that needed to be said,
yes.
Not because it was necessarily good. I don't want to put words in people's mouths. However, Sean goes on to write, while I have a harder time arguing for Fear and Loathing, Hunter S. Thompson did invent gonzo journalism, so by definition, I think it fits.
Well, Fear and Loathing was one that came up a lot. Sean, again, not alone there. But Good Night and Good Luck, we did give it 3 stars. We both liked it.
Yeah.
I don't think we want to rehash our reasons for maybe not loving it here. You can go back and listen to that show, whatever episode of Film Spotting it was. But it was a film we both liked, didn't love, but it was the most popular entry that came in. Maybe second, actually, because now that I think about it, this next film we're going to discuss actually came in, I think, even more times than Good Night and Good Luck did. And we start with Hennessy in Alexandria, Virginia. I don't know if you haven't seen it or just couldn't get past young Luke Skywalker in the starring role, but I have to say that you missed the boat not having Shattered Glass on your list of top five journalism films. I'm sure you're going to get a lot of feedback about this film, so I will be brief. If All the President's Men defines the journalistic movie, then Shattered Glass sets the new boundaries for the 21st century. All the altruistic intent of the journalists and All the President's Men is balanced by the slimy nature of Glass. You also have great performances by Hayden Christensen and Peter Sarsgaard and Hank Azaria that make for a really good film, and I think worthy of at least a number 3 on anyone's journalism list.
Wow. Well, I know a lot of people do like this film, including our friend Matt Singer, loves this film,
mm-hmm.
almost apologizes for loving it so much. I like it a lot.
Yeah. Why don't you read Brody's email here, Sam, too?
Yeah, we've got Brody here who writes, hey, Adam and Sam, your 14-year-old fan here wanting to comment on the top five journalism movies list. A great list, but there is one movie that I think should get more credit in general, Shattered Glass. Bad title pun aside, writes 14-year-old Brody,
mm-hmm.
Billy Ray's film about the rise and fall of cocky young journalist Stephen Glass is mesmerizing and brings the world of journalism into a certain perspective. Of course, Peter Sarsgaard was fantastic, when is he not? But it convinced me that Hayden Christensen could actually pull off a good performance without inept dialogue about sand. Well done, Brody.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I like it. I think, like Billy Ray's Breach, it's one of these movies that kind of worked on me over time. His simplicity in terms of his directing style.
Sure.
I think his integrity in some way
really
impresses me. And I think Hayden Christensen's performance, too, actually works over time.
I do, too.
I think it's good.
I do think it's good, but it's funny. As I wrote back to one listener, I believe it was Will here in Chicago who wrote in, I said, yeah, Shattered Glass is good, but I'm sorry, it's not going ahead of The Parallax View or Network or the five films on my list. That's the problem sometimes, of course, with a top five list. But, you know, it just wouldn't make my top 10 maybe of journalism films, despite the fact that I do like it. And I agree with you. Hayden Christensen, who I think is really pretty awful in just about everything, his character, his persona, actually works perfectly as the Stephen Glass character, as this really whiny guy who's always trying to please everyone and is really kind of shady. I mean, I really thought it actually was great casting there.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think it becomes a really smart performance. At first, you do think that it's just a Hayden Christensen performance, and then you realize, no, wait, there's strategy here, and whether it's the directors or Christensen himself, it's hard to say.
Well, Good Night and Good Luck and Shattered Glass were the two most popular entries. This one was actually the third among listeners this week, and this one comes from Bob Kester here in Chicago, who says, my big addition to the journalism list is The Paper. It gives a more vivid sense of the newspaper business as a day-to-day, minute-to-minute struggle between commerce, crusade, and private life than anything else I've seen. Plus, it is the only Ron Howard film worth watching a second time. Just checked his list to make sure. Apparently, Bob
Cinderella
hasn't
Man.
Seen Cinderella Man.
Come
on. A little gem, Sam. So he wrote in, Bob did, about The Paper. A lot of people wrote in, and I thought that was interesting only because I have not seen The Paper. Despite my love for Michael Keaton, I've never been that curious about it, mainly because I've always kind of heard it wasn't that good.
I don't know if it's one of those films I just happened to see at the right time where it's just inoffensive in some way,
mm-hmm.
and I liked it. I think it's I remember it not being stupid in terms of what it tries to get at.
Yeah.
You know, it's not overly sentimental. I do like Michael Keaton. It didn't blow me away, but I remember liking it.
Okay.
I don't think Bob's crazy.
No, okay.
All right, well, we do have one more here from Tariq, writing from Lincoln, Nebraska, who writes, just wanted to write you about two movies I thought were noticeably absent in your top five, both of which are about journalists and coincidentally also take place in Southeast Asia. The first is The Killing Fields, which is, in my opinion, one of the best Vietnam War movies to have been made, although it takes place in Cambodia, which was, as we know now, a brutal sideshow for U.S. misadventurism in the region. This is simply a great movie and very much unlike the celebration of journalists as heroes you see in All the President's Men. Additionally, have you seen The Year of Living Dangerously? This movie is the only Western one I know that depicts the failed Indonesian coup of 1965, which was just another domino and just as important part of the Southeast Asian theater to the U.S. as Vietnam and the mainland nations were. Yes, there's a lot of junk in this movie, but the atmosphere and color are great, and it manages to integrate a number of really interesting themes without preaching. See these movies if you haven't. Both are great. That's Tariq in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Tariq in Lincoln, who is way smarter than both of us,
very,
obviously.
Very, very bright.
But Year of Living Dangerously, I have to confess, Cinecast Confession, have not seen it, that Mel Gibson film.
Right.
And Tariq was one of a handful of people that wrote in about it, so I am more curious to check it out. Now, The Killing Fields, for me, is one of those movies, Sam, I know you've seen it,
yeah.
And I did consider it along with Salvador, which was another one that brought up a lot in emails.
Yeah.
But for me, The Killing Fields, I have to admit, is one of those films that I think Sam Waterston in it, of course, but
right.
It was one of those films that I don't think I've ever seen from start to finish. You know how there are some films
yeah.
that you feel like you've seen the whole thing because they're on all the time on HBO or whatever growing up? I feel like I've seen it, but I can't tell you anything about it, so I had to omit it. It is one I need to go back and revisit for sure.
Yeah, Killing Fields for me is one of those films I probably saw before I was old enough to really appreciate it.
Yeah.
I may have been 12 or 13. Why I was watching The Killing Fields at that age, I don't know, but
mm-hmm.
I was too young, and so my memory of it isn't strong enough to be considered for the top five, but I'm sure if I revisited it now, it certainly would be a good candidate.
Yeah, well, as always, we appreciate all of your feedback. If you have more for us, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, or give us a call, 206-203-CINNA, 206-203-2463.
We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, Adam and I go thrill crazy, kill crazy, over gun crazy. And we're not saying that's necessarily a good thing. Stay with us.
So there's no truth. Look at us, can blind our eyes till blood comes through.
Time now to take a look at what's new on DVD coming out this Tuesday, except that, Sam, it's the bleakest week ever for new DVDs.
Wow.
I mean, literally, there isn't one DVD worth mentioning.
This is the winter of DVDs.
It is.
The winter of our discontent.
We're not going to mention any. We're going to move on to a few brief notes before we get to donations. I want to first thank some of our listeners who I had a chance to meet up with last week during my trip to Columbus. We had a little Columbus meetup. I got a chance to talk with Chris and Carrie and Dodd and Ben. And we had a lot of fun, had a couple beers, hung out for a couple hours, and talked about movies and the show. All of them, Sam, pro Death Proof over Planet Terror.
Oh, really?
So they all have
good
taste.
Good.
And Ben Yakshaw, a student there at Columbus, at Ohio State University, a student filmmaker, gave me his film, 9-Minute Love Song. I had a chance to check it out. It's a cross between Evil Dead and Death Proof. Very well done. So
wow.
You're going to be hearing more from Ben Yakshaw. So
no,
I had fun there. And then also the next night, I got a chance to hang out with one of our listeners, Shashi. Had a great talk with him. Friends of Seema Pie, Sam, in Seattle.
Oh, yeah.
A longtime listener, Seema.
Wow.
So anyway, just wanted to thank everyone again, including the people who couldn't make it. There was a lot of interest in the Columbus meetup. Some people just couldn't make it, but I had a lot of fun. So,
well, yeah, I was actually in Philadelphia over the weekend and had an unintentional film spotting meetup
really?
At my friend Katie's wedding. Turns out Katie... My friend Katie McCory and her new husband Tom are listeners, and somebody that I had known in college, Laura, had been listening to the show as well.
Really?
So we had a nice time. Listeners, film spotting listeners are everywhere, apparently, even among those people that I already know and didn't know were listening.
Did they tell you that they agree with me more often than you?
Of course.
Of course.
Just like my wife.
Fantastic. Okay, well, other quick note, we did get a lot of people who wrote in about the new AFI list, the 100 Years, 100 Movies 10th Anniversary Edition. And maybe we're going to have to find time on a future show, Sam, to talk about this list a little bit more in depth. Maybe a top five mistakes, top five surprises. But they did redo the top 10 here, and there were some interesting, well, they did the whole 100, but some interesting touches to the top 10. Raging Bull, love to see this, went up 20 spots to number 4. Vertigo went up 52 spots to number 9. I don't think we'd argue with those.
No way.
City Lights, the Chaplin film, which I do like quite a bit, up 65 spots to number 11. And The Searchers, John Ford's film, the John Wayne movie, I love, Sam, didn't like quite as much, up a whopping 84 spots
Amazing.
To number 12.
Yeah, so worth it for John Wayne alone.
It is worth it for John Wayne alone. But again, they redid the entire top 100, but those were the big key changes up top. Citizen Kane still number 1. The Godfather up from number 3 to 2. Casablanca dropped from 2 to 3. So that's the top 10 of the AFI list, and it is something we'll get into a little bit later on a future show, I'm sure.
Definitely. All right, well, a few people we want to thank for going to filmspotting.net, clicking on the PayPal link, and donating some of their hard-earned money in exchange for an official Film Spotting nickname. Mm-hmm. Those are Abdullah, the Esoteric Escort, Karen, Iambic, Pentathlon, Alex, Seven Iron, Calypso, Kurt, Most Deserving of Mercy, that's a Silver Club member, and Samuel, Pucker Up, Pink Ox. Thanks to everyone who donated to Film Spotting this week.
Oh, yeah, I lost one of your shoulder pads. I think it drowned. How was your evening, anyway?
What do you mean, flop sweat? You're making too much out of this. I bet you were the only one aware of it.
People phoned in.
Stop kidding with me. I want to know what happened.
I'm not kidding.
There were complaining phone calls because you were sweating.
No, nice ones. Worried that I was having a heart attack.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Van Holgren. It's time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I destroy a beloved screenplay and you get a shot at a free DVD. Last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard from The Great Broadcast News, a tie-in with last week's top five movies about journalism.
Yes, many people writing in with praise for your Holly Hunter, Sam. It was very good, but
Thank you.
My Albert Brooks, not so good, and
yeah,
boy, do I know.
Yeah, people really came
down
hard on
it. I tried. I even worked on it. I worked on it.
I know. We'll reach into that Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Erica Calvert from somewhere in California. I believe Erica's from Reseda, which is just a fun name to say.
It is
so
fun.
Erica Calvert from Reseda, California. Congratulations. Send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Now, you guys got to look menacing. Can you be more menacing?
Moving on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. It ties in with Paris Je T'Aime. That's a big hint.
Yes,
so think about directors. You start it, Sam, so I'm going to go ahead and give you the action.
All right.
And action.
He always does this. I'm surprised he can exist this time.
How do we know he's okay?
Well, he's not dead. Listen. He's not dead. He just passed out. It's a condition.
He really scared the shit out of that old lady. What causes it? Sex?
Narcolepsy doctors say it's brought on by certain chemical reactions in the brain. It comes about in situations of stress. Some hustler, huh?
Where are we going to take him? We can't just leave him here.
And scene.
All right, if you know what film we just massacred, send us an email by Wednesday, July 5th to feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Friday's show. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
I don't want to be afraid of life or anything else. I want a guy with spirit and guts. A guy who can laugh at anything, who'll do anything. A guy who can kick over the traces and win the world for me.
Look, I don't want to look in that mirror and see nothing but a stick-up man staring back at me.
You better kiss me goodbye, Bart. Because I won't be here when you get back.
It's just that some guys are born smart about women and some guys are born dumb. That's Bluey the Clown giving some insightful and unheeded advice to Bart Terre, the born dumb about women hero of Joseph Lewis's 1950 B-movie noir, Gun Crazy. If you have any doubt about the thematic importance of this bit of dialogue or the movie's B-movie status, consider the alternate title, Deadly is the Female. Gun Crazy is the story of a gun-obsessed kid who grows up to be a reluctant outlaw after falling in with the wrong woman. Adam, of the 11 marathons we've done, the noir marathon so far has been by far the most divisive. Aside from your less than thrilled response to Robert Siodmak's The Killers, you've had to play champion of the genre while I've shown some impatience with some of noir's most famous tropes, the stylized language, the cynical, emotionally removed heroes, and their occasionally confusing motives, or confusing for me. As often happens when someone's experience doesn't jibe with critical or popular consensus, listeners have suggested that I just don't get film noir. I'll certainly admit to never having read John Tuska's Dark Cinema, American Film Noir in Cultural Perspective, one of four titles suggested to me by listener Scott Bongs Before Breakfast Yarborough. But if it requires a syllabus for me to appreciate noir, I'm not sure it's worth it. Is it possible that I simply don't care for noir? Is the mere suggestion blasphemous? And what to make of Gun Crazy? Is the proto Bonnie and Clyde even noir? It's certainly got a noir heroine, the tough as nails Annie Laurie Starr, played by Peggy Cummins, who makes life miserable for our existentially stricken hero. But what else? Adam, resident defender of noir?
Yes.
How does Gun Crazy stand up against the rest of the films in our marathon?
Well, first, I can't believe you actually said Scott Bongs Before Breakfast
when
he hates that nickname.
I did it intentionally because he gave me a syllabus.
Yeah, that's true. So you'll get a bad nickname or you'll refuse
to change
it.
I'll get a bad grade
it.
Anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, this film for me, I have to admit, would be my least favorite in the marathon so far. Compared to the other films we've talked about, Double Indemnity, Out of the Past, and The Killers, I would put it at the bottom of the list. And it is more of a curio for me. I mean, I think that there are reasons to see it beyond enjoyment or really loving it like I did those other films. And you touched on it. This is a huge influence on Bonnie and Clyde, the Arthur Penn film, and later Terrence Malick's Badlands. So I think to see it in that context is important. But
yeah.
In the noir context, I think the reason to really pay attention to this film and give it some critical thought is because it stands in such a marked contrast to the other films we've seen so far in that. And again, you mentioned this really is truly a B picture.
Yeah.
I mean, there is some marvelous filmmaking. Most famously, of course, the Unbroken bank heist sequence. Really marvelous. It's got some improvised dialogue or allegedly improvised dialogue.
Right.
And we literally get put in the back seat where we have to become
yes.
an accomplice to this robbery where we're in the back seat watching Bart and Annie Laurie Starr as they plan this robbery and actually commit it and then head out of town. And it's all one unbroken take. It's really fantastic. Alfonso Cuarón would be so proud.
He'd be so proud.
So I loved that part. And, of course, the cinematography is also fantastic in some of the early scenes too, where we get even just the opening shot, I think is really fantastic in terms of the way it's lit. But you watch these scenes and it almost crosses a line in many parts, I think, into camp with the performances and some of the dialogue. I mean, watching Peggy Cummins yell at the cops, come any closer, I'll shoot ya, and how she gets almost sexually charged up when they're escaping from the cops on that
yeah.
robbery, it really does become almost comical, almost unintentionally funny, I think. And you watch there's a fevered, kind of jagged way the whole film is made, really in your face, where there's a lot of extreme close-ups and candid angles. And so, you know, unlike the other three movies we've talked about, those really seem to me as impeccably made films. Whether you like them or not,
yes.
you can see all the care that really went into making it seem flawless in some way, if that even makes sense. And here you get the sense that Joseph Lewis, the director, really didn't care at all about having something be immaculate. He was really going for the visceral, trying to get a reaction out of you. Doesn't matter if it's slightly out of focus. Doesn't matter if the camera movement seems a little too abrupt or dramatic. That jagged quality I mentioned that's really there, that's what he's going for. And then when you put it in this larger context of B movies and these qualities, you think about Tarantino and you see
yeah.
where Planet Terror and Death Proof came from.
I mean,
you literally watch the first 5 minutes of this film and you see the influence this movie had to have on Tarantino specifically, but others as well. So with all of those things in mind, I think it's a must see in terms of really getting drawn into the story and caring at all about our heroes or even caring how they came out in the end. I can't say I really did, mainly because I thought their performances were pretty stiff and not very good. But those are the reasons I would say Gun Crazy is absolutely worth seeing.
Well, yeah, I think if people were to decide what they think of my perception of films in some way based on my dislike of noir, I don't think this will help any in that I had a blast with this film.
Of course,
I mean,
you
in
did.
Many ways,
of course,
this is
did.
Not noir. In many ways, of course, all the things that I've talked about not really getting into with Out of the Past and Double Indemnity, and again, for the fourth week in a row, I will state on the record these are not films I disliked. They are just not films I loved as passionately as my co-host and so many of you out there.
Right.
But I had a blast with this movie. You said almost unintentional comedy. How about absolutely unintentional comedy? Laugh out loud, unintentional comedy. And that didn't take anything away from it, but it certainly added to my enjoyment of it. But as far as what wasn't necessarily working for me as well in Double Indemnity, Out of the Past, these sort of unemotional noir heroes, we do not have that here. Our Bart, played by John Dahl, is feverishly emotional,
yeah.
And his degree of passion for guns first, and then for Peggy Cummins, Annie Laurie Starr, the gunslinging Annie Laurie Starr, is really kind of thrilling to watch. I mean, I've talked about in the past how I don't really have much need for movies that are so bad it's good. I'm not going to say this movie is bad necessarily, but this might be the exception in some way, probably because it's not really bad for a lot of the reasons you mentioned.
Right.
Cinematography, this is really interesting. But the script, a lot of the direction, and most of the acting is bad,
yes,
but good, because the intentions are so clear.
Right.
It's almost like this screenplay was like badly translated from another language or something. It's so – or it's like somebody writing from a foreign language and trying to capture the kind of rhythms of American speech or something. It's all so aggressive, so surface level. And I was reminded, and I know this is going to sound condescending, but I really did ultimately and sincerely enjoy watching this film. It reminded me of watching like a small town production or even a high school production of a good play, where the level of acting is lower than what you'd have as a standard.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like, and all they get is the subtext. All the actors really get and understand is the intention of the characters.
Sure.
It's like, I'm into guns, I'm into this chick.
Uh-huh.
So I'm really feeling it, man, you know, and like,
right.
And I can buy that. I can go with a story like that, and everyone is really, really involved. And I think that's part of my enjoyment of it, was that the intentions were really clear, the motivations were really clear, and I think it really is psychologically and like existentially kind of complex in a way, in terms of like the suffering that our lead character goes through. I believe and I sympathize with, because I understand, even as much of a hell on wheels as Peggy Cummins is, I understand why he is so powerfully attracted to her.
Yeah.
There is something like essentially sexy,
sure,
sexual about her, and I totally get it. And so I get why, as much as he wants to leave her behind and knows he should because he's a good person, he just can't do it. So that's the enjoyment too.
Yeah.
It's unintentional comedy, so bad it's good quality to it, but it also was really thrilling, and I was really invested in all the characters.
Yeah, well, I wasn't invested in the way you were, but it's funny what you say about Peggy Cummins, because she is an interesting take on the femme fatale compared to what we have seen before, in that one big reason that she's different is that she never really dupes Bart. I mean, she makes her intentions and her needs are very clear from the start. She doesn't have to
trick the level.
Yeah, into anything. And so the key scene in the film where you're sure that, you know, she's going to double-cross him. We've seen it in every noir film. She's clearly just going to take the money and run. She doesn't. When Bart comes and jumps back into her car, even though it's not the right thing to do, she's happy about it. They're both happy. They want to be together. So there is something about it that again, makes it stand out from other noirs, and I think for that reason needs to be seen. And I love what you said, too, about the kind of subtext of it, because I found a quote from the director talking to an author who was writing a book about noir and this film, and according to the director, he told in the scene where they first meet, the shoot 'em up scene in the carnival or whatever, he told John Dahl, "Your cock's never been so hard," and I told Peggy, "You're a female dog in heat and you want him, but don't let him have it in a hurry. Keep him waiting."
Well, you don't even need to know that.
No, you don't.
Because that is what you see.
Because that
movie
is what you see, and it's you know, I have a hard time imagining Billy Wilder giving that kind of direction. You know, I mean, that's what's different about this film. But I just feel like really, John Dahl is this guy who was in Rope and he was in Spartacus and mainly a lot of TV stuff. And this was one of his first movies, and it really shows for me. I mean, for me, this is like textbook bad acting, where you're literally watching someone like feel his way and try to figure out how he's supposed to emote.
But I found
it
really
screen.
Charming, too.
Yeah, I
really likable and really charming. I agree. It's definitely stiff. It's just like a poor man's Jimmy Stewart in many cases. But I really liked him as I would like. And this, again, I'm sorry for the condescension. As I would like the lead in a high school play, you know, doing West Side Story or something.
Right.
I'm like, okay, I know you're not that character at all.
Yeah.
But I like you. I think you're doing a good job. You're really committed.
Well, I love the West Side Story reference, too, because Russ Camblin is the young Bart,
the young
John Dahl character. He is the 14-year-old Bart who we see at the beginning. And that's another problem I have with the film. Russ Camblin, even though he hardly says a word, is much darker and more mysterious and interesting as the 14-year-old Bart than John Dahl is for the rest of the film.
Well, you have to admit to being surprised when John Dahl does show up. You're expecting this really kind of messed up guy who's obsessed with guns, and he's like happy-go-lucky.
Right.
And
he's been through reform school, and apparently reform school actually works.
Yeah, it works. He has nothing good to say about that in the Army.
Yeah.
But I think that's part of it. Watching it in the context of these other films, you keep expecting things to go terribly wrong. And, of course, they go terribly wrong, but not in any way you're prepared for based on watching this in the context of other noirs.
Yeah.
All right. Well, next week, we'll continue the marathon with The Asphalt Jungle. We're going to take one last quick break. When we come back, Adam and I take the dust cover off the casting couch and pick the five actors we'd cast in our movie. Stay with us.
How do we get back to our ships? We're poor sailors. How do we return to the sea? And how do I reach down deep inside and remove something bigger than I could ever be?
Film Spotting's Top 5 is presented by Spout.com. Share your lists, reviews, and discuss movies with your friends for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
What about you? What do your dad think about you?
Stop. Stop it. It's what you said from the beginning. If I tell him what happened, they'll arrest you and put you in jail.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Sam Van Halgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and that was a quick scene from Mulholland Drive featuring Naomi Watts,
which
I play, Sam, because Naomi Watts is not going to make my top five list, my top five actors, actresses I'd cast in my movie. And the reason why is I'm calling this the Naomi Watts thinks you're a stalker and refuses to work with you memorial
You're
list.
Afraid of Liev Schreiber.
I am, actually. So another good guy I should have considered for my list, actually, Sam. Thanks a lot. Where were you 2 hours ago when I was putting this list together? But Naomi Watts is not going to make my list. And we are going to do this list a little differently. And we should say, too, this is a list that we came up with. Actually, Candace, our fine helper with the show, I think originally came up with this list, tying in with Ocean's 13.
Yes, that's
and
right.
We pushed it off. Thought it did work well with Je T'aime because you're talking about a movie directed by all these directors. If you're putting together your murderer's row of directors, you'd put together guys like Gus Van Sant and the Coen brothers and Alfonso Cuarón.
Right.
And here we're thinking of actors that if we were Hollywood moguls, we had no budgetary constraints, we could cast whoever we wanted. Who would we want in our movie? That's what we're doing here. We're going to do it differently. I think I'm going to go first and just quickly rattle off the five or seven or so that I've picked. I have a feeling you've gone over the five as well, Sam.
I have about eight. That's true.
Okay. Well, mine, I think, is going to be a little simpler than yours. I think you put way too much time into this.
I had way too much fun. It's true.
You've come up with an entire script.
This movie, I've got a pitch.
You have a pitch.
Yeah. Brett Merriman, are you listening? Yeah. I want to draft the script by next Monday.
One of our screenwriters, one of our directors out there, you're going to make this film. Okay, well, we'll start with mine. And I don't have an overarching theme. I don't have a script. I don't have a treatment. But I do have an idea how it all might tie together. But I'm going to start with one actor I'm putting in. I'm calling my unknown. This is my unknown actor who I want to see get more work.
Yep.
And it's actually Dan Futterman.
Ooh.
The screenwriter and actor who we saw in A Mighty Heart is Daniel Pearl. And again, he did write the screenplay for Capote, which, as one listener corrected us from last week, he didn't win the Oscar for the screenplay. He was only nominated, but I think he's a really interesting actor.
I like it.
I really thought he was good in A Mighty Heart. He's a guy I would like to see get more work and a variety of roles. You could see him playing a guy that's just kind of a good person, an idealist, but I think he probably has more range than that. I'd like to see him get more work. So my unknown is Dan Futterman. Then I'm going to my rising star, and unfortunately, you stole it early, Sam. You mentioned her with Parrish Attem, Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Yeah.
I need some women in this film. I'm putting Maggie Gyllenhaal. Everyone knows who listens to the show regularly that I loved her last year, both in World Trade Center, which was an okay film, and in Sherry Baby. I thought she was fantastic. I think she's a really interesting fearless actress. I know you love that word, Sam.
Yeah. And she's brave.
That's right. She's brave. And I'm really excited to see her in The Dark Knight coming up.
Yes.
The Christopher Nolan film, of course, the next installment. Yeah, yeah, taking over that kind of Katie Holmes role where it's like they actually realized they needed to cast a real actor in the role. So
right.
I'm glad to see that. My scene stealer is going to be Ray Winston.
Nice.
I'm putting him in. I considered Alec Baldwin, who they were both in The Departed together, but my scene stealer is Ray Winston. And actually, from here on out, I'm going to get very international. There's going to be a real international flavor to my movie here, Sam. Ray Winston, of course, brilliant in The Proposition, also a small role in The Departed, and Sexy Beast. He's the main character, really, next to Ben Kingsley in Sexy Beast. And I think here, maybe in my movie, and this will make more sense later, he's not old enough to be the dad, but maybe the wise but troubled older uncle.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay, I like it. I like
Ray
it
Winston.
See, it's taking shape. The story is taking shape.
Now, here's my female lead. And this is going to surprise you, and it surprised me because up until I saw Paris Jatem, I was not thinking of this person.
Mm.
But I love this actress, and my female lead is Juliette Binoche.
Of course, great pick.
Juliette Binoche, I mean, really, that scene, you talked about it, the story with her and Willem Dafoe as a cowboy, and it's really this parable about grief where she's clearly lost a son.
Yeah.
And is anyone out there right now better able to just capture in a single look grief and yet intelligence and just this fierceness and just, you know, intelligence. She's just so smart and yet so sensual and sexy at the same time.
Good pick.
I think she's brilliant. She's my female lead, which brings me to my stars, my male lead. And notice I said stars because I am cheating. I've got three actors. I know at least one of them, is going to appear on your list. But Sam, here's how I'm justifying it. My movie is a brother's story.
Perfect.
I've got three brothers. Again, Ray Winston's the uncle. I see Juliette Binoche as the older love interest that maybe two of the brothers were fighting over. Got a little love triangle going. My brothers are Clive Owen, British, of course, Christian Bale.
Oh, good.
Welsh. And then, keeping the international, non-U.S. theme going here, your man, Ryan Gosling.
Gosling.
A Canadian.
Those are my,
can you just see those guys as brothers in a movie?
I love it.
Tell me you wouldn't go out and pay $100 to see that movie.
Amazing.
I know Alex in Dallas right now, he's having a lot of impure thoughts thinking about this movie, and I don't blame him, frankly. And if you look at their ages, here's something I bet you didn't know. How old do you think Clive Owen is in relation to Juliette Binoche?
Yeah, I bet he's maybe closer in age than we'd think.
They're actually the same age.
Amazing.
They're 43. And yet, again, it's that whole thing about how Hollywood works, where Clive Owen can play a 30-year-old or whatever, a 35-year-old, and you think of Juliette Binoche as older than that.
Oh, that's
incredible.
As
someone who maybe couldn't fall in love with him. But they're both 43. He's the older brother. Christian Bale's 33, can play older. He's the middle brother.
Mm-hmm.
And then the younger brother, the 27-year-old Ryan Gosling. That's my movie.
Wow.
I don't know how they're all fitting in. I don't know what Maggie Gyllenhaal and
Dan Futterman
are doing.
I wondered what she was doing there.
I don't know. But that's my movie, Sam.
Dan Futterman, Maggie Gyllenhaal, Ray Winston, Juliette Binoche, Clive Owen, Christian Bale, Ryan Gosling.
That's it. How did I do?
That is a murderer's row. That's amazing.
Thank you. Okay, well, I can't wait to hear yours.
I made a very different kind of film.
Okay.
First, I put together my wish list. This is who I came up with after having to cut a few, unfortunately. Sam Rockwell somehow didn't make the cut. Gael Garcia Bernal, Zoe Deschanel, Topher Grace, Casey Affleck, James LaGross, that's my Dan Futterman.
Nice.
Paul Giamatti, Jeff Goldblum, and Diane Keaton. Okay, so I was like, now what kind of movie are these kind of people going to be in?
Uh-huh.
And I realized it was probably going to be something like Bottle Rocket because it's my favorite movie. It's going to be some kind of quirky romance, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the title of the movie is called Haitian Divorce. Gael Garcia Bernal is the front man for a Steely Dan cover band. Also in the band, Casey Affleck and James LaGross. I think LaGross is probably on drums.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Giamatti is the band manager.
Yes.
Jeff Goldblum and Diane Keaton, Bernal's adoptive parents, they open for the band with these folk rock tunes, original folk rock tunes. They are friends with Donald Fagen and Walter Becker.
Yes.
Of course, who make cameo appearances. Zoe Deschanel, and here's where it takes a turn and you'll realize why. Even though I'll be writing this with Brett Merriman, it's going to be directed by Spike Jonze.
Okay, of course.
I've already got the director. So they go to city, very well-received Steely Dan cover band. Name of the band, of course, is Haitian Divorce. And in every city he goes in, every city the band goes to, there is a girl in the audience, and it is, of course, Zoe Deschanel. She is the exact same girl in every city, but she's not the same girl.
Gotcha.
Okay?
Intriguing.
Her boyfriend is played by Topher Grace. At every new city, of course, there's this girl. Bernal, of course, is in love with her. She loves Steely Dan. She loves the band. But again, she is the exact same girl, speaks the same, maybe not the same name, but looks the same, doesn't act any different. But she is a different person in every city. And she and Topher are at a different stage of their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've got here is Being John Malkovich meets Groundhog Day meets Nashville.
Charlie Kaufman wrote this, right?
Charlie Kaufman, of course, wrote this. He has yet to write this. It's his next project. But yeah, so I got my work cut out for me. But again, Haitian Divorce, starring Gael Garcia Bernal, Zoe Deschanel, Topher Grace, Casey Affleck, James LaGross, Paul Giamatti, Jeff Goldblum, Diane Keaton, directed by Spike Jonze.
Very nicely done. I mean, really, that list is kind of a compilation of every actor, you especially, but me included in many instances, have over the course of 2 years of doing this show, have singled out as people a lot of times don't get enough love.
People
who are really kind of overlooked, underappreciated, some actors we love to see in movies, and that's exactly the kind of list I expected you to come up with. And that film, I mean, Hollywood, we know you're listening to the show.
Yes.
Make these movies.
Make these movies.
People would run out and pay a lot of money to see these films.
You know, we would. We would review them positively.
We would.
Yeah.
We might be the only ones, but we would review them positively.
That's right.
All right, that's it. Well, I can't wait to get some responses. And it was so hard, Sam. I mean, really, you think about the people you had to leave off. I mean, how did you leave off P.S. Hoffman?
Oh, God, I know. But believe me, I thought about it, and I'm just like, this guy, for a movie, originally, I came up with my list, and I was just like, I first imagined myself as writer-director.
Yeah.
And I'm like, who do I want to surround myself with? As much as I, you know, admire Philip Seymour Hoffman as an actor, I think he kind of takes himself a little seriously.
Yeah.
He's a little bit of a heavy. You know, put him in the Ed Norton camp for, like, you know, kind of, you know, a little bit getting into the character a little bit too much, wants a little bit too much direction.
Uh-huh.
I don't want somebody that's going to be asking me the motivation of their character every other day.
Okay.
And again, you probably, a lot of people were, when they heard about this top five, were like, oh, well, you know, Pacino, De Niro, Meryl Streep. Naomi Watts, kind of obvious picks.
Right.
But again, I was thinking of, like, if I'm going to surround myself with a bunch of actors for 8, 10 weeks, 3 months, because we're still writing the script while we're shooting. You know, that's the kind of – these are the kind of people that come up with stuff on their own.
Right.
You know, and again, Sam Rockwell would have made a great pick, but he didn't make the cut in the band.
Well,
I don't know.
Was it just too obvious, Sam? How did you leave off Jeffrey Wright?
Again, I'm sure he's got some comic chops like Philip Seymour Hoffman does, but – I wasn't feeling the vibe with him. Believe me, I considered him.
You did.
Yeah, but all of these people
you
passed
interviewed
the test.
Him. You had a talk about the
I was
script.
Just like, I just don't know if you get my vision.
Uh-huh.
Goldblum is thrilled.
I bet.
I mean, he had his little side, you know, he did the TV for a while. He's ready to come back. You know, I think we got the right group together.
Okay. Well,
for Haitian Divorce.
I think we came up with two good lists. You definitely have a great title. I'll need to work on the title. Actually, that should be a film spotting contest, is come up with a title and a story for my movie with Ryan Gosling, Christian
right.
Bale, you know,
oh,
and
three
Clive
brothers,
Owen.
One woman.
Okay, well,
that's
those
the
are
tagline.
The top five actors we'd cast in our movie. Please send your top five or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message. And opening and wide release this weekend, as we mentioned, Ratatouille, the Brad Bird film. We do like Brad Bird.
Yes,
Sam.
We do.
The Iron Giant, of course, and The Incredibles. And we are going to see this film at some point. Evening is opening with Claire Danes, Toni Collette, Glenn Close, Meryl Streep, Vanessa Redgrave, speaking of Murderer's Row.
That's right.
Sicko, the Michael Moore film. We will talk about it next week with special guest host Scott Smith. And we'll also talk about Transformers. And we'll get to the penultimate film in our noir marathon, The Asphalt Jungle.
Thanks to Alex and Angela on our message boards, Frank Huckle, Candace Griffiths, and email editor Jeff Houston. Thanks also to the Winter Sounds and Live Wire Recordings for this week's music. Learn more at livewirerecordings.net.
Distributed through the Public Radio Exchange, Film Spotting is available for broadcast on your local public radio station. Information is available on our website, filmspotting.net. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar. Sam, enjoy packing up boxes.
Thank you so much. And I am Sam Van Hallgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout. Visit filmspotting.spout.com to discuss this episode.
How badly are we going to massacre
Oh, my Lord. I don't even want to think about it.
Oh, God. It's going to be brutal. nobody cares about Paris Jatem. We could have just talked about Die Hard, for God's sakes. No, I'm glad I saw it. It was interesting. It's just like, unless you've seen it, even if you have seen it, trying to follow that conversation.